The Man in the High Castle, Cassette 6.
Chapter 12. Mr. Ramsay said, "Mr. Tagomi, this is Mr. Yatabi." He retired to a corner of the office, and the slender, elderly gentleman came forward. Holding out his hand, Mr. Tagomi said, "I am glad to meet you in person, sir." The light, fragile old hand slipped to his own. He shook without pressing and released at once. "Nothing broken, I hope," he thought. He examined the old gentleman's features, finding himself pleased. Such a stern, coherent spirit there. No fogging of wits. Certainly lucid transmission of all the stable ancient traditions. Best quality which the old could represent. And then he discovered that he was facing General Tadeki, the former Imperial Chief of Staff. Mr. Tagomi bowed low. "General," he said. "Where is the third party?" General Tadeki said. "On the double he nears," Mr. Tagomi said. "Informed by self at hotel room." His mind utterly rattled, he retreated several steps in the bowing position, scarcely able to regain an erect posture. The general seated himself. Mr. Ramsay, no doubt still ignorant of the old man's identity, assisted with the chair but showed no particular deference. Mr. Tagomi hesitantly took a chair facing.
"We loiter," the general said. "Regrettably, but unavoidably."
"True," Mr. Tagomi said. 10 minutes passed. Neither man spoke. "Excuse me, sir," Mr. Ramsay said at last, fidgeting. "I will depart unless needed." Mr. Tagomi nodded, and Mr. Ramsay departed.
"Tea, General," Mr. Tagomi said.
"No, sir."
"Sir," Mr. Tagomi said, "I admit to fear. I sense in this encounter something terrible." The general inclined his head. "Mr. Baines, whom I have met," Mr. Tagomi said, "and entertained in my home, declares himself a Swede, yet perusal persuades one that he is in fact a highly placed German of some sort. I say this because—"
"Please continue."
"Thank you. General, his agitation regarding this meeting causes me to infer a connection with the political upheavals in the Reich." Mr. Tagomi did not mention another fact, his awareness of the general's failure to appear at the time anticipated. The general said,
"Sir, now you are fishing, not informing."
His gray eyes twinkled in fatherly manner, no malice there. Mr. Tagomi accepted the rebuke. "Sir, is my presence in this meeting merely a formality to baffle the Nazi snoops?"
"Naturally," the general said.
"We are interested in maintaining a certain fiction. Mr. Baines is representative for Tor Am Industries of Stockholm, purely businessman, and I am Shinjiro Yatabe." Mr. Tagomi thought, "And I am Tagomi. That part is so."
"No doubt the Nazis have scrutinized Mr. Baines's comings and goings," the general said.
He rested his hands on his knees, sitting bolt upright, as if, Mr. Tagomi thought, he were sniffing far-off beef tea odor.
"But to demolish the fiction, they must resort to legalities. That is the genuine purpose. Not to deceive, but to require the formalities in case of exposure. You see, for instance, that to apprehend Mr. Baines they must do more than merely shoot him down, which they could do were he to travel as, well, travel without his verbal umbrella."
"I see," Mr. Tagomi said. "Sounds like a game," he decided. "But they know the Nazi mentality, so I suppose it is of use." The desk intercom buzzed, Mr. Ramsay's voice. "Sir, Mr. Baines is here. Shall I send him on in?" "Yes," Mr. Tagomi cried. The door opened, and Mr. Baines, sleekly dressed, his clothes all quite pressed and masterfully tailored, his features composed, appeared. General Tadeki rose to face him. Mr. Tagomi also rose. All three men bowed. "Sir," Mr. Baines said to the general, "I am Captain R. Wegener of the Reich Naval Counterintelligence. As understood, I represent no one but myself and certain private, unnamed individuals, no departments or bureaus of the Reich government of any sort." The general said, "Herr Wegener, I understand that you in no way officially allege representation of any branch of the Reich government. I am here as an unofficial private party who, by virtue of former position with the Imperial Army, can be said to have access to circles in Tokyo who desire to hear whatever you have to say." Weird discourse, Mr. Tagomi thought, but not unpleasant. Certain near-musical quality to it. Refreshing relief, in fact. They sat down. "Without preamble," Mr. Baines said, "I would like to inform you, and those you have access to, that there is in advanced stage in the Reich a problem called Lovinzahn, dandelion." "Yes," the general said, nodding as if he had heard this before, but Mr. Tagomi thought he seemed quite eager for Mr. Baines to go on. "Dandelion," Mr. Baines said, "consists of an incident on the border between the Rocky Mountain states and the United States." The general nodded, smiling slightly. "U.S. troops will be attacked and will retaliate by crossing the border and engaging the regular RMS troops stationed nearby. The U.S. troops have detailed maps showing Midwest Army installations. This is step one. Step two consists of a declaration by Germany regarding the conflict. A volunteer detachment of Wehrmacht paratroopers will be sent to aid the U.S. However, this is further camouflage." "Yes," the general said, listening. "The basic purpose of Operation Dandelion," Mr. Baines said, "is an enormous nuclear attack on the home islands without advance warning of any kind." He was silent then. "With purpose of wiping out royal family, home defense army, most of Imperial Navy, civil population, industries, resources," General Tadeki said, "leaving overseas positions for absorption by the Reich." Mr. Baines said nothing. The general said, "What else?" Mr. Baines seemed at a loss. "The date, sir," the general said. "All changed," Mr. Baines said, "due to the death of M. Bormann. At least, I presume, I am not in contact with the Abwehr now." Presently, the general said, "Go on, Herr Wegener." "What we recommend is that the Japanese government enter into the Reich's domestic situation. Or at least, that was what I came here to recommend. Certain groups in the Reich favor Operation Dandelion, certain others do not. It was hoped that those opposing it could come to power upon the death of Chancellor Bormann." "But while you were here," the general said, "Herr Bormann died, and the political situation took its own solution. Dr. Goebbels is now Reich's Chancellor. The upheaval is over." He paused. "How does that faction view Operation Dandelion?" Mr. Baines said, "Dr. Goebbels is an advocate of Dandelion." Unnoticed by them, Mr. Tagomi closed his eyes. "Who stands opposed?" General Tadeki asked. Mr. Baines' voice came to Mr. Tagomi. "SS General Heydrich." "I am taken by surprise," General Tadeki said. "I am dubious. Is this legitimate information or only a viewpoint which you and your colleagues hold?" Mr. Baines said, "Administration of the East, that is the area now held by Japan, would be by the Foreign Office. Rosenberg's people working directly with the Chancery. This was a bitterly disputed issue in many sessions between the principals last year. I have photostats of notes made. The police demanded authority but were turned down. They are to manage the space colonization, Mars, Luna, Venus. That's to be their domain. Once this division of authority was settled, the police put all their weight behind the space program and against Dandelion.
Rivalry, General Tedeki said. One group played against another, by the leader.
So he is never challenged.
True, Mr. Bain said. That is why I was sent here, to plead for your intervention. It would still be possible to intervene. The situation is still fluid. It will be months before Dr. Goebbels can consolidate his position. He will have to break the police, possibly have Heydrich and other top SS and SD leaders executed. Once that is done, we are to give support to the Sicherheitsdienst, General Tedeki interrupted. The most malignant portion of German society? Mr. Bain said, that is right. The Emperor, General Tedeki said, would never tolerate that policy. He regards the Reich's elite corps, wherever the black uniform is worn, the death's head, the castle system, all to him is evil.
Evil, Mr. Tagumi thought. Yes, it is. Are we to assist it in gaining power in order to save our lives? Is that the paradox of our earthly situation? I cannot face this dilemma, Mr. Tagumi said to himself. That man should have to act in such moral ambiguity. There is no way in this. All is muddled, all chaos of light and dark, shadow and substance. The Wehrmacht, Mr. Bain said, the military, is sole possessor in the Reich of the hydrogen bomb. Where the black shirts have used it, they have done so only under army supervision. The Chancery under Bormann never allowed any nuclear armament to go to the police. In Operation Dandelion, all will be carried out by OKW, the Army High Command.
I am aware of that, General Tedeki said.
The moral practices of the black shirts exceed in ferocity that of the Wehrmacht. But their power is less. We should reflect solely on reality, on actual power, not on ethical intentions.
Yes, we must be realists, Mr. Tagumi said aloud.
Both Mr. Baines and General Tedeki glanced at him. To Mr. Baines, the general said,
What specifically do you suggest?
That we establish contact with the SD here in the Pacific States? Directly negotiate with... I do not know who is SD chief here, some repellent character, I imagine.
The local SD knows nothing, Mr. Bain said. Their chief here, Bruno Kreutz von Mehrer, is an old-time Partei hack, ein Altparteigenosse, an imbecile. No one in Berlin would think of telling him anything. He merely carries out routine assignments.
What then?
The general sounded angry.
The consul here, or the Reich's ambassador in Tokyo?
This talk will fail, Mr. Tagumi thought. No matter what is at stake, we cannot enter the monstrous, schizophrenic morass of Nazi internecine intrigue. Our minds cannot adapt.
It must be handled delicately, Mr. Bain said, through a series of intermediaries. Someone close to Heydrich who is stationed outside of the Reich in a neutral country, or someone who travels back and forth between Tokyo and Berlin.
Do you have someone in mind?
The Italian foreign minister, Count Ciano. An intelligent, reliable, very brave man, completely devoted to international understanding. However, his contact with the SD apparatus is non-existent. But he might work through someone else in Germany, economic interests such as the Krupps, or through General Speidel, or possibly even through Waffen-SS personages. The Waffen-SS is less fanatic, more in the mainstream of German society.
Your establishment, the Abwehr, it would be futile to attempt to reach Heydrich through you.
The black shirts utterly revile us. They've been trying for 20 years to get Partei approval for liquidating us in toto.
Aren't you in excessive personal danger from them?
General Tedeki said.
They are active here on the Pacific coast, I understand.
Active but inept, Mr. Bain said. The Foreign Office man, Rice, is skillful but opposed to the SD.
He shrugged. General Tedeki said,
I would like your photostats to turn over to my government any material you have pertaining to these discussions in Germany, and, he pondered, proof of objective nature.
Certainly, Mr. Bain said. He reached into his coat and took out a flat silver cigarette case. You will find each cigarette to be a hollow container for microfilm. He passed the case to General Tedecky.
What about the case itself?
The general said, examining it. It seems too valuable an object to give away. He started to remove the cigarettes from it. Smiling, Mr. Bain said, the case, too.
Thank you.
Also smiling, the general put the case away in his topcoat pocket. The desk intercom buzzed. Mr. Tagomi pressed the button. Mr. Ramsey's voice came.
Sir, there is a group of SD men in the downstairs lobby. They are attempting to take over the building. The Times guards are scuffling with them.
In the distance, noise of a siren. Outside the building from the street below Mr. Tagomi's window.
Army MPs are on the way, plus San Francisco Kempeitai.
Thank you, Mr. Ramsey, Mr. Tagomi said. You have done an honorable thing to report placidly.
Mr. Baines and General Tedecky were listening, both rigid.
Sirs, Mr. Tagomi said to them, we will no doubt kill the SD thugs before they reach this floor.
To Mr. Ramsey he said, turn off the power to the elevators.
Yes, Mr. Tagomi.
Mr. Ramsey broke the connection.
Mr. Tagomi said, we will wait.
He opened his desk drawer and lifted out a teakwood box. Unlocking it, he brought forth a perfectly preserved U.S. 1860 Civil War Colt 44, a treasured collector's item. Taking out a box of loose powder, ball and cap ammunition, he began loading the revolver. Mr. Baines and General Tedecky watched wide-eyed.
Part of personal collection, Mr. Tagomi said. Much fooled around in vainglorious swift draw practicing and firing in spare hours. Admit to compare favorably with other enthusiasts in contest timing, but mature use heretofore delayed.
Holding the gun in correct fashion, he pointed it at the office door and sat, waiting.
At the bench in their basement workshop, Frank Frink sat at the arbor. He held a half-finished silver earring against the noisily turning cotton buff. Bits of rouge spattered his glasses and blackened his nails and hands. The earring, shaped in a snail shell spiral, became hot from friction, but Frink grimly bore down even more.
Don't get it too shiny, Ed McCarthy said. Just hit the high spots. You can even leave the lows completely.
Frank Frink grunted.
There's a better market for silver if it's not polished up too much, Ed said. Silver work should have that old look.
Market, Frink thought. They had sold nothing. Except for the consignment at American Artistic Handcrafts, no one had taken anything, and they had visited 5 retail shops in all. We're not making any money, Frink said to himself. We're making more and more jewelry, and it's just piling up around us. The screw back of the earring caught in the wheel. The piece whipped out of Frink's hands and flew to the polish shield, then fell to the floor. He shut off the motor.
Don't let those pieces go, McCarthy said at the welding torch.
Christ, it's the size of a pea. No way to get a grip.
Well, pick it up anyhow.
The hell with the whole thing, Frink thought.
What's the matter?
McCarthy said, seeing him make no move to fish up the earring. Frink said, we're pouring money in for nothing.
We can't sell what we haven't made.
We can't sell anything, Frink said, made or unmade.
5 stores, drop in the bucket.
But the trend, Frink said, it's enough to know.
Don't kid yourself, Frink said.
I'm not kidding myself.
Meaning what?
Meaning it's time to start looking for a market for scrap.
All right, McCarthy said. Quit then.
I have.
I'll go on by myself. McCarthy lit the torch again.
How are we going to split the stuff?
I don't know, but we'll find a way. Buy me out, Frank said. Hell no, Frank computed. Pay me $600. No, you take half of everything, half the motor. They were both silent then. Three more stores, McCarthy said. Then we'll talk about it. Lowering his mask, he began brazing a section of brass rod into a cuff bracelet. Frank Frink stepped down from the bench. He located the snail shell earring and replaced it in the carton of incomplete pieces. I'm going outside for a smoke, he said, and walked across the basement to the stairs. A moment later, he stood outdoors on the sidewalk, a Tien Lai between his fingers. It's all over, he said to himself. I don't need the oracle to tell me. I recognize what the moment is. The smell is there. Defeat. And it's hard, really, to say why. Maybe, theoretically, we could go on, store to store, other cities. But something is wrong, and all the effort and ingenuity won't change it. I want to know why, he thought, but I never will. What should we have done? Made what instead? We bucked the moment, bucked the Tao, upstream in the wrong direction, and now dissolution, decay. Yin has us. The light showed us its ass, went elsewhere. We can only knuckle under. While he stood there under the eaves of the building, taking quick drags on his marijuana cigarette, and dully watching traffic go by, an ordinary-looking, middle-aged white man sauntered up to him. Mr. Frink? Frank Frink? You got it, Frink said. The man produced a folded document and identification. I'm with the San Francisco Police Department. I have a warrant for your arrest. He held Frink's arm already. It had already been done. For what? Frink demanded. Bunko, Mr. Childan, American Artistic Handcrafts. The cop forcibly led Frink along the sidewalk. Another plainclothes cop joined them, one now on each side of Frink. They hustled him toward a parked, unmarked Toyopet. This is what the time requires of us, Frink thought as he was dumped onto the car seat between the two cops. The door slammed shut. The car, driven by a third cop, this one in uniform, shot out into traffic. These are the sons of bitches we must submit to. You got an attorney? One of the cops asked him. No, he said. They'll give you a list of names at the station. Thanks, Frink said. What did you do with the money? One of the cops asked later on as they were parking in the Kearney Street police station garage. Frink said, spent it. All? He didn't answer. One of the cops shook his head and laughed. As they got out of the car, one of them said to Frink, is your real name Fink? Frink felt terror. Fink, the cop repeated. You're a kike. He exhibited a large gray folder. Refugee from Europe. I was born in New York, Frank Frink said. You're an escapee from the Nazis, the cop said. You know what that means? Frank Frink broke away and ran across the garage. The three cops shouted, and at the doorway he found himself facing a police car with uniformed, armed police blocking his path. The police smiled at him, and one of them, holding a gun, stepped out and smacked a handcuff into place over his wrist. Jerking him by the wrist, the thin metal cut into his flesh to the bone, the cop led him back the way he had come. Back to Germany, one of the cops said, surveying him. I'm an American, Frank Frink said. You're a Jew, the cop said. As he was taken upstairs, one of the cops said, will he be booked here? No, another said. We'll hold him for the German consul. They want to try him under German law. There was no list of attorneys, after all. For 20 minutes, Mr. Tagomi had remained motionless at his desk, holding the revolver pointed at the door while Mr. Baines paced about the office. The old general had, after some thought, lifted the phone and put through a call to the Japanese embassy in San Francisco. However, he had not been able to get through to Baron Kaela Makuli. The ambassador, a bureaucrat, had told him, was out of the city.
Now General Tadeki was in the process of placing a trans-Pacific call to Tokyo.
I will consult with the War College, he explained to Mr. Baines. They will contact Imperial military forces stationed nearby us.
He did not seem perturbed. So we will be relieved in a number of hours, Mr. Tagomi said to himself. Possibly by Japanese marines from a carrier armed with machine guns and mortars. Operating through official channels is highly efficient in terms of final result, but there is regrettable time lag. Down below us, black shirt hooligans are busy clubbing secretaries and clerks. However, there was little more that he personally could do. I wonder if it would be worth trying to reach the German consul, Mr. Baines said. Mr. Tagomi had a vision of himself summoning Miss Afrakian in with her tape recorder to take dictation of urgent protest to Herr H. Reiss. I can call Herr Reiss, Mr. Tagomi said, on another line. Please, Mr. Baines said. Still holding his Colt 44 collector's item, Mr. Tagomi pressed a button on his desk. Out came a non-listed phone line, especially installed for esoteric communication. He dialed the number of the German consulate.
Good day, who is calling?
Accented brisk male functionary voice, undoubtedly underling. Mr. Tagomi said,
His Excellency Herr Reiss, please, urgent. This is Mr. Tagomi here, ranking Imperial Trade Mission, top place.
He used his hard, no-nonsense voice.
Yes, sir, a moment, if you will.
A long moment, then. No sound at all on the phone, not even clicks. He is merely standing there with it, Mr. Tagomi decided, stalling through typical Nordic wile. To General Tadeki, waiting on the other phone, and Mr. Baines pacing, he said, I am naturally being put off. At last, the functionary's voice once again,
Sorry to keep you waiting, Mr. Tagomi.
Not at all.
The consul is in conference, however...
Mr. Tagomi hung up. Waste of effort, to say the least, he said, feeling discomfited. Whom else to call? Tokoka already informed, also MP units down on waterfront. No use to phone them. Direct call to Berlin, to Reich Chancellor Goebbels, to Imperial Military Airfield at Napa asking for air rescue assistance.
I will call SD Chief Herr B. Kreutz von Meyer, he decided aloud, and bitterly complain, rant and scream invective.
He began to dial the number formally, euphemistically, listed in the San Francisco phone book as the Lufthansa Airport Terminal Precious Shipment Guard Detail. As the phone buzzed, he said, Vituperate in high-pitched hysteria.
Put on a good performance, General Tadeki said, smiling.
In Mr. Tagomi's ear, a Germanic voice said,
Who is it?
More no-nonsense-than-myself voice, Mr. Tagomi thought, but he intended to go on.
Hurry up,
the voice demanded. Mr. Tagomi shouted,
I am ordering the arrest and trial of your band of cutthroats and degenerates who run amok like blonde berserk beasts, unfit even to describe. Do you know me, Kerl? This is Tagomi, Imperial Government Consultant. 5 seconds or waive legality and have Marines shock troop unit begin massacre with flame-throwing phosphorus bombs. Disgrace to civilization.
On the other end, the SD flunky was sputtering anxiously. Mr. Tagomi winked at Mr. Baines.
We know nothing about it, the flunky was saying. Liar, Mr. Tagomi shouted. Then we have no choice.
He slammed the receiver down. It is no doubt mere gesture, he said to Mr. Baines and General Tadeki. But it can do no harm anyhow. Always faint possibility, certain nervous element even in SD. General Tadeki started to speak. But then a tremendous clatter at the office door. He ceased. The door swung open. 2 burly white men appeared, both armed with pistols equipped with silencers. They made out Mr. Baines.
Da ist er,
one said. They started for Mr. Baines. At his desk, Mr. Tagomi pointed his Colt 44 ancient collector's item and compressed the trigger. One of the SD men fell to the floor. The other whipped his silencer-equipped gun toward Mr. Tagomi and returned fire. Mr. Tagomi heard no report, saw only a tiny wisp of smoke from the gun, heard the whistle of a slug passing near. With record-eclipsing speed, he fanned the hammer of the single-action Colt, firing it again and again. The SD man's jaw burst. Bits of bone, flesh, shreds of tooth flew in the air. Hit in the mouth, Mr. Tagomi realized. Dreadful spot, especially if ball ascending. The jawless SD man's eyes still contained life of a kind. He still perceives me, Mr. Tagomi thought. Then the eyes lost their luster, and the SD man collapsed, dropping his gun and making unhuman, gargling noises.
Sickening, Mr. Tagomi said.
No more SD men appeared in the open doorway.
Possibly it is over,
General Tadeki said after a pause. Mr. Tagomi, engaged in tedious 3-minute task of reloading, paused to press the button of the desk intercom. Bring medical emergency aid, he instructed. Hideously injured thug here. No answer, only a hum. Stooping, Mr. Baines had picked up both the Germans' guns. He passed one to the general, keeping the other himself.
Now we will mow them down, Mr. Tagomi said, reseating himself with his Colt 44 as before. Formidable triumvirate in this office.
From the hall, a voice called, German hoodlums, surrender.
Already taken care of, Mr. Tagomi called back. Lying, either dead or dying. Advance and verify empirically.
A party of Nippon Times employees gingerly appeared, several of them carrying building riot equipment such as axes and rifles and tear gas grenades.
Cause célèbre, Mr. Tagomi said. PSA government in Sacramento could declare war on Reich without hesitation.
He broke open his gun.
Anyhow, over with.
They will deny complicity, Mr. Bain said. Standard technique, used countless times. He laid the silencer-equipped pistol on Mr. Takumi's desk. Made in Japan. He was not joking. It was true. Excellent quality Japanese target pistol. Mr. Tagomi examined it. And not German nationals, Mr. Bain said. He had taken the wallet of one of the whites, the dead one. PSA citizen, lives in San Jose. Nothing to connect him with the SD. Name is Jack Sanders. He tossed the wallet down.
A hold-up, Mr. Tagomi said. Motive, our locked vault. No political aspects.
He arose shakily to his feet. In any case, the assassination or kidnapping attempt by the SD had failed. At least, this first one had, but clearly they knew who Mr. Baines was, and no doubt what he had come for.
The prognosis, Mr. Tagomi said, is gloomy.
He wondered if in this instance the Oracle would be of any use. Perhaps it could protect them, warn them, shield them with its advice. Still quite shaky, he began taking out the 49 yarrow stalks. Whole situation, confusing and anomalous, he decided. No human intelligence could decipher it, only 5,000-year-old joint mind applicable. German totalitarian society resembles some faulty form of life worse than natural thing. Worse in all its admixtures, its potpourri of pointlessness. Here, he thought, local SD acts as instrument of policy totally at odds with head in Berlin. Where in this composite being is the sense? Who really is Germany? Whoever was? Almost like decomposing nightmare parody of problems customarily faced in course of existence. The Oracle will cut through it. Even weird breed of cat like Nazi Germany comprehensible to I Ching. Mr. Baines, seeing Mr. Tagomi distractedly manipulating the handful of vegetable stalks, recognized how deep the man's distress was. For him, Mr. Baines thought, this event, his having had to kill and mutilate these two men, is not only dreadful, it is inexplicable. What can I say that might console him? He fired on my behalf. The moral responsibility for these two lives is therefore mine, and I accept it. I view it that way. Coming over beside Mr. Baines, General Tadeki said in a soft voice, "You witness the man's despair. He, you see, was no doubt raised as a Buddhist. Even if not formally, the influence was there. A culture in which no life is to be taken. All lives holy." Mr. Baines nodded. "He will recover his equilibrium," General Tadeki continued, "in time. Right now he has no standpoint by which he can view and comprehend his act. That book will help him, for it provides an external frame of reference." "I see," Mr. Baines said. He thought another frame of reference which might help him would be the doctrine of original sin. I wonder if he has ever heard of it. We are all doomed to commit acts of cruelty or violence or evil. That is our destiny, due to ancient factors, our karma. To save one life, Mr. Tagome had to take two. The logical, balanced mind cannot make sense of that. A kindly man like Mr. Tagome could be driven insane by the implications of such reality. Nevertheless, Mr. Baines thought, the crucial point lies not in the present, not in either my death or the death of the two SD men. It lies, hypothetically, in the future. What has happened here is justified or not justified by what happens later. Can we, perhaps, save the lives of millions? All Japan, in fact. But the man manipulating the vegetable stalks could not think of that. The present, the actuality, was too tangible. The dead and dying Germans on the floor of his office. General Tadeki was right. Time would give Mr. Tagome perspective. Either that, or he would perhaps retreat into the shadows of mental illness, avert his gaze forever due to a hopeless perplexity. And we are not really different from him, Mr. Baines thought. We are faced with the same confusions. Therefore, unfortunately, we can give Mr. Tagome no help. We can only wait, hoping that finally he will recover and not succumb. Chapter 13. In Denver, they found chic, modern stores. The clothes, Juliana thought, were numbingly expensive, but Joe did not seem to care or even to notice. He simply paid for what she picked out, and then they hurried on to the next store. Her major acquisition, after much trying on of dresses and much prolonged deliberating and rejecting, occurred late in the day. A light blue Italian original with short, fluffy sleeves and a wildly low neckline. In a European fashion magazine, she had seen a model wearing such a dress. It was considered the finest style of the year, and it cost Joe almost $200. To go with it, she needed three pairs of shoes, more nylon stockings, several hats, and a new handmade black leather purse. And, she discovered, the neckline of the Italian dress demanded the new brassieres, which covered only the lower part of each breast. Viewing herself in the full-length mirror of the dress shop, she felt overexposed and a little insecure about bending over. But the salesgirl assured her that the new half bras remained firmly in place despite their lack of straps. "Just up to the nipple," Juliana thought as she peered at herself in the privacy of the dressing room. "And not one millimeter more. The bras, too, cost quite a bit. Also imported," the salesgirl explained, "and handmade." The salesgirl showed her sportswear, too, shorts and bathing suits and a terry cloth beach robe. But all at once Joe became restless, so they went on. As Joe loaded the parcels and bags into the car, she said, "Don't you think I'm going to look terrific?" "Yes," he said in a preoccupied voice. "Especially that blue dress. You wear that when we go there, to Abinson's. Understand?" He spoke the last word sharply, as if it was an order. The tone surprised her. I'm a size 12 or 14, she said as they entered the next dress shop. The salesgirl smiled graciously and accompanied them to the racks of dresses. What else did she need? Juliana wondered. Better to get as much as possible while she could. Her eyes took in everything at once, the blouses, skirts, sweaters, slacks, coats. Yes, a coat. Joe, she said, I have to have a long coat, but not a cloth coat. They compromised with one of the synthetic fiber coats from Germany. It was more durable than natural fur and less expensive, but she felt disappointed. To cheer herself up, she began examining jewelry. But it was dreary costume junk without imagination or originality. I have to get some jewelry, she explained to Joe, earrings at least, or a pin to go with the blue dress. She led him along the sidewalk to a jewelry store. And your clothes, she remembered with guilt. We have to shop for you, too. While she looked for jewelry, Joe stopped at a barber shop for his haircut. When he appeared a half hour later, she was amazed. He had not only gotten his hair cut as short as possible, but he had had it dyed. She would hardly have recognized him. He was now blonde. Good God, she thought, staring at him. Why? Shrugging, Joe said, I'm tired of being a wop. That was all he would say. He refused to discuss it as they entered a men's clothing store and began shopping for him. They bought him a nicely tailored suit of one of DuPont's new synthetic fibers, Dacron, and new socks, underwear, and a pair of stylish, sharp-toed shoes. What now? Juliana thought. Shirts and ties. She and the clerk picked out two white shirts with French cuffs, several ties made in France, and a pair of silver cufflinks. It took only 40 minutes to do all the shopping for him. She was astonished to find it so easy compared to her own. His suit, she thought, should be altered, but again Joe had become restless. He paid the bill with the Reichsbank notes which he carried. I know something else, Juliana realized. A new billfold. So she and the clerk picked out a black alligator billfold for him, and that was that. They left the store and returned to the car. It was 4:30, and the shopping, at least as far as Joe was concerned, was over. You don't want the waistline taken in a little? She asked Joe as he drove out into downtown Denver traffic. On your suit? No. His voice, brusque and impersonal, startled her. What's wrong? Did I buy too much? I know that's it, she said to herself. I spent much too much. I could take some of the skirts back. Let's eat dinner, he said. Oh, God, she exclaimed. I know what I didn't get. Nightgowns. He glared at her ferociously. Don't you want me to get some nice new pajamas? She said. So I'll be all fresh and... No! He shook his head. Forget it! Look for a place to eat. Juliana said in a steady voice, We'll go and register at the hotel first so we can change. Then we'll eat. And it better be a really fine hotel, she thought, or it's all off, even this late. And we'll ask them at the hotel what's the best place in Denver to eat, and the name of a good nightclub where we can see a once-in-a-lifetime act. Not some local talent, but some big names from Europe, like Eleanor Perez or Willie Beck. I know great UFA stars like that come out to Denver because I've seen the ads, and I won't settle for anything less.
This ends side one of cassette 6. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.